First of all, I need a clear motivation of what I'm going to study. Well, I'm always interested in gauge theories in four dimensions with various amounts of supersymmetry. And in my talk today, I will mainly be talking about n equals 4 gauge theory in four dimensions, although much of the methods I will discuss actually also apply to n equals 0. So that's interesting because it describes nature, right? The second thing I need for my job to be straightforward is basically a clear question of what I want to do. And what I want to do today has to do with the second bit of my title. Due to all kinds of developments in the literature, it is now a clear question to ask, can I write this four-dimensional gauge theory as a gauge theory defined on twisted space, which is actually a six-dimensional space? So that's my clear question. The third thing I need for my job to be straightforward is that the answer you get from your research is pretty simple and clear. And I hope to convince you that although my answer looks a bit contrived here and there, it is actually very simple. And the last thing you need for my talk to be at least also enjoyable for the audience, I think, is that in the end you arrive at lots of open questions and open problems which actually may have solutions. Okay, after this ad for my talk, let's go to the real stuff. First, I should tell you what this talk is based on. This talk is mainly based on a paper by me, Lionel Mason, and David Skinner, which appeared now 1.5 months ago. And it's also partly based on a paper we're in the process of writing, although we have some minor problems we might tell you about, which is due to be this year. And I should give a shout out to Lionel Mason because the things we're doing in this paper are based on a line of research which was begun by him in this paper. I'll come back to that a bit later. Okay. So let me give you a very brief outline of what I want to do today. I'll start by giving you a fairly extensive introduction into the subject. I apologize for those who already know everything about it, but I think that's nice for the other people in the audience. After that, we have a slight technical intermezzo because I have to tell you some things about twisted space, which you will need if I want to construct an action on it. After I've done that, I'll show you that our action actually reproduces both the standard, in this case, n equals 4 Young-Mills action, but it also gives you, in a different gauge, it gives you the CSW rules of calculating scattering amplitudes. And I hope to end with some conclusions, speculations, and open problems. Okay, so to begin with the introduction. Now, most of you know already that if you like to calculate anything in perturbative gauge theory, then that is usually pretty hard. And not hard in the sense that it's difficult to understand, it's just hard in the sense that you have to calculate lots and lots of things. But that doesn't stop people from calculating these things anyway. So, there's lots of things known, of course, because this is a very interesting subject. And it turns out that some results are actually pretty simple when you express them in the right variables. And the right variables in this case are spinor or Lissy variables. Let me briefly remind you of the fact that they can write any vector as basically a bi-spinor by contracting it with the Dirac sigma matrices. And this procedure will lead you to identify some 4-vector with some 2x2 matrix. And lots of the simplifications you get in this subject are due to the fact that 2x2 matrices only have 2 eigenvectors. So if I calculate the determinant of this matrix, I get something which you might recognize as the norm of this 4-vector. And if this norm vanishes, then I know that I only have at most 1 non-trivial eigenvector left. And I can express my entire 4-vector or 2x2 matrix in this case, as just one particular eigenvector. This notation is pretty common in this subject, where you write things which actually have 2 indices as things which have 1 index. I hope the distinction is clear from the notation, otherwise please tell me if something is illegible. I'll also use the fact that I can contract indices on these objects with 1 index, and I'll write for the contraction with the unbounded index, I'll write this particular bracket. And for the contraction with the prime index, I'll write this bracket. Those of you who are more familiar with supersymmetry notation primed and unprimed is basically the same as dotted and undotted. Okay. Now, I promise you that some results are in game theory were pretty simple. So let me give you an example of what is pretty simple. So you consider helicity amplitudes. You divide up all the incoming particles and label them according to their helicity. And if I have all the momentum inward pointing, I have either plus or minus helicity with respect to that convention. And you get, for instance, for an amplitude where I have four of these minus particles coming in and two pluses coming in, you get in the notation I just drew, you get this particular factor out for this amplitude. This amplitude is the sum of lots and lots of diagrams. But the result you get is kind of simple. These amplitudes, where you get two of one kind and the rest of the other kind, are called MHV amplitudes for maximal helicity violating. And that's actually a bad name, I think, because there are much simpler amplitudes which are really MHV. And those are the things where you get only pluses or only minuses. Because at tree level, these just vanish. And actually, there are papers in the literature, if you ever are going to bone up in the literature, where these things are called MHV amplitudes instead of these things. Anyway, in my talk, this will be an MHV amplitude. You could also study this at loop level, and then for this particular one, where you get all pluses, generically, it's not the result will be non-zero. But you can also show that if you have any supersymmetry left in your system, that amplitude is zero. So these are pretty simple because they're all zero. And you can also study the case where you get one minus and the rest of the pluses, which also vanishes at tree level and also at loop level if you've got supersymmetry. I skipped one point, sorry about that. If I write an amplitude in a scattering amplitude in the Yang-Mills theory, I should also tell you exactly what happens to the color factors. And I'll use the fact that you can always write at the tree level any amplitude as some standard color factor times some amplitude where you've ordered all your particles. It's called color ordering. It will not be very important in this talk, but anytime I write an amplitude like that, I actually mean this amplitude summed over non-cyclic permutations times the trace of some product of color matrices. But the basic question you should be left with here is, why is this so simple? And this is the point where we get to the subject of twisted strings. Those of you who already know a bit about the subject, I use a lot of arguments which actually just come from Whitman's paper, because I think it shows most clearly exactly where things go right and go wrong. But let's start with Whitman's paper anyway. Whitman's main idea, I think, and I'm second guessing here, because Freddie wasn't someone to tell me what the real idea was. Whitman thinks that the simplicity of these amplitudes is basically due to a relationship with twisted states. And in this case, you should think of twisted states as being CP3. And I think he also knew this from the literature, and he definitely refers to it in his paper, by an earlier article by Nair in 1988. So what he basically shows is that these amplitudes have a natural lift to twisted space. One describe here what it means exactly. However, he combines it with another idea. He also thinks that, hey, if these amplitudes are so simple in twisted space, why don't I try to study them in a form of topological field theory? And you might wonder why you would go for topological field theory, but these amplitudes are, in some sense, holomorphic, and holomorphic things is sort of a mantra you should study by using topological theories. So, another thing Whitman definitely knows is that if you have twister space, you have a very standard result from the literature, which basically tells you that if I want to study unshelled massless spacetime fields, so fields which obey field equations, then what I need to study on twister space are the local homology classes on CP3. And there's a one-to-one correspondence between these. I'm suppressing a lot of technical detail here, but most twister correspondence is just study this. So, armed with all this knowledge, you look in your catalog of topological field theories, and what can you write down on CP3? Then there's basically two natural guesses you can make, as far as I can see. The first one you can make is to study something called holomorphic transcendence theory. Holomorphic transcendence theory is the theory you get when you study a complex threefold and you divide all your directions up into holomorphic and angulomorphic directions. You take a holomorphic, or just any old free common knot form, and you wedge it against what you should recognize as the transcendence form, but now a holomorphic transcendence form, because these A's are not of one field, and you get some theory known as holomorphic transcendence theory. I should note here that the other natural guess you could have made at this point is that you have some form of BF theory, and we'll come back to that later on. But let's stick with this one for a while. If you derive the field equations, or the linearized field equations of the theory, what you'll get, as you can see very quickly, is that A is basically a closed not in one form. This theory has a Gaussian invariant, which looks like this. So basically, the field equations of this particular theory are telling you that A on shell is really just plain and simple, a double cohomology class in CP3. So this is very encouraging, because then you start to get into the swing of things. And at this point, you should know another fact from the literature, and that is that holomorphic transcendence theory popped up once before. And it popped up in a paper by Whitten again as the string field theory you get for if you study the open topological B model. So then you can ask the question, is the simplicity of these MFE amplitudes by a study like this, is that related to an open topological B model? And that's sort of should be at least you very exciting, because then you would relate some Gardner variety gauge theory to a topological string theory, which is in some sense the simplest string theory you can get. However, this cannot be really true, because if it were the topological B model, the target space of that model would have to be Calabi-Yau, otherwise you get an anomaly. Now, CP3 itself is definitely not Calabi-Yau, so that doesn't work. However, the next idea would be is to add supersymmetry to the manifold itself, because CP3/4 is Calabi-Yau, it's a super Calabi-Yau manifold. I'll get back to why it's super Calabi-Yau in a second. If you would study holomorphic transcendence theory with this target space, then the field A I just wrote down, starts to become a super field, right? So if I just take it and expand it, right, you need to remind you that this is a not normal one form, so all of these fields which are underlined in red are also not normal one forms on CP3. This starts to look like an n equals 4 multiplet. And if you're on shell, then this is the n equals 4 multiplet, because twisted correspondence would then tell you that this is a gluon, that is a fermion, that is. Those are scalars, that's a fermion again, and that's a gluon again. Now, I have to stress at this point, because I gave this talk in Berlin a week ago, and there was much confusion about this one. This is only a gluon, and this is only a scalar if you're on shell. So only if I have the field equations. Otherwise, it's an off-shell n equals 4 multiplet, which is interesting in some way. I need some more things if I want to write down the same action I wrote down before. I need a volume element to integrate over CP3/4. So the resulting part is kind of easy, because if I take the homogeneous coordinates, so it's coordinates in C4, and I mod out by the scaling, I get a natural volume element on CP3, which looks like this. Now, if I scale my homogeneous coordinates by some scale lambda, this entire volume element scales as lambda to the power 4, right? So everything as we know in green here is basically its dimension on the scale, the charge on the scale. Now, if I add to that basically the integral over the fermionic directions I have on my manifold, then because of the wonders of fermionic integration, this thing has scaling dimension -4. So if I multiply these two together, I have a form which has weight 0 on CP3 set 4. So since it has weight 0, it descends, instead of being a form on written in homogeneous coordinates on C4, it descends to a form on CP3/4. So it's a holomorphic 3 form, and manifolds will have nowhere finishing holomorphic 3 forms coming up as Calabi-Yau manifolds. If I write that action down, I better also tell you how the field A scales under scalings like this. If this is a null form, then this is also a null form. This has one fermion, so this is a minus one form, and so you can fill out the entire multiple in this one. So what I've just written down is holomorphic transcendence theory on CP3/4. It contains some field A, which looks like an E+4 field, and it contains also some kind of vertex. So you might start to wonder, is this the entire story? And this would be, I should stress again, would be extremely nice, because then you would have rewritten, well, okay, it's not the garden variety N=0 theory, but it's N=4 theory, which is also a non-trivial theory. You would have written that as a string theory. It's a topological string theory, as it turns out. But maybe I should have covered up the answer in the end. The question is, best you know, and the reason why it can't be a complete theory is basically that if you study the interactions of this theory, you see that you're missing some stuff. So at this point, you would like to add something to this holomorphic transcendence theory in order that the action you write down then is the complete N=4 super-Yang Mills action.
So this N=4, this simple field form is a twister space, right?
Yes.
So this Psi I is just like the super coordinates.
Sorry?
This Psi I is like this N=4 super the coordinates of super space. This A.
You mean this Psi?
Yes, this Psi.
Yeah, these Psi are the fermionic directions on CP3/4.
CP3.
Yeah, so it's not space time, it's twister space. It's pretty similar, but it's not completely the same because
it's completely linear.
Okay. I have something more to say about this a bit further on. Okay, but I told you that this holomorphic transcendence bit can be a complete story. So, Witten then starts to look in his catalog of ideas, and he tries to cook up a term to add to the action in order that what you get ends up being just plain old Yang-Mills theory. And what Witten is going to consider are D1 rays, or in this case, D1 instantons, because if we would add one brain to the theory, what it would have is one brain wrapping one CP1 in my CP3/4, and that would break all kinds of symmetries. So what I do is I integrate over all possible ways of wrapping a CP1 inside my CP3/4. The action of one of these D1 brains is simply an action like this, where beta and alpha are the Higgs group transforming the fundamental of the Higgs group and are, in this case, considered to be fermionic. So you add this action to the theory and you have to integrate over the modular space of all the different ways in which you can embed things like this inside CP3/4. And then the first question you should ask is, how do I calculate if adding stuff like this to the theory gives you complete N=4. How can I calculate any scattering amplitude in it because it looks completely unfamiliar? And then it turns out that you can cook up a conjecture of what kind of instantons to the theory calculate what kind of amplitudes. In any case, I can always classify the ways in which I can wrap CP1s and CP3/4 by the degree of the embedding map and the genus of the resulting curve, and what you get is that the degree of the curve is related to the number of minus gluons that plug in, as minus one plus the number of loops. Okay, this is a bit esoteric, so let me give you one example. If I take the genus, or the number of loops in this case, to be zero, and look at degree one embeddings of CP1s inside CP3/4, then the Q, the number of minus gluons, is 2, and the rest of the gluons in my theory will be plus 10. So I'm studying MHV amplitudes at zero loops. So this is the MHV 3 amplitude if everything works out. And the following calculation I just sort of copied directly from Witten. Witten tells you that the derivative functional of these MHV amplitudes is given by the integral over the moduli space of all embeddings of CP1s at degree 1. And you have to calculate the determinant of the del bar operator of this gauge field A. So, well, determinants you already know you can always write as the partition function of some auxiliary field. Here the A, alphas and betas again. And I have to integrate this over a degree 1 embedded CP1 inside my twisted space. I told you, or at least claimed, that this was a generating functional for amplitude, so I can expand it in powers of basically the inserted gluonic field. And what I have to calculate then, if I expand out in this terms of this A, I have to calculate correlation functions in an auxiliary two-dimensional field theory, which is something we all should know and love. So what do you get? Well, let's look at the four-point amplitude, because that illustrates the entire procedure. In the four-point case, I expand it out in four parts. The gluon field, and I get a bunch of these fermions. Now I have to contract these fermions according to basically the rules of the field theory. And you see that there's in principle two different ways in which I can contract these particular fermions. I can contract beta 1 with alpha 2, beta 2 with alpha 3, beta 3 with alpha 4, and then complete it in this particular way. And there's all kinds of other permutations of this where I contract every fermion with every other fermion. Witten then shows in favor that these contractions will give you MHV amplitudes, all of them. Or at least in this case, it's a 4.1, so that's not a lot of possibilities here. And you get the color factors correct, and everything is nice and dandy. The problem is that you can also contract it in this way. Right? And what do you get? Well, you get, if you calculate it, you get a trace of two separated color factors, and you get this particular combination where these straight brackets should actually be these angle brackets. Now, the first problem with this thing is not performance supergraphy, which I meant here. The problem is that this object does not appear in gauge theory at three levels. But then you can start to wonder what it actually is. So then, yeah, you work it out, and it turns out that this thing looks like basically two vertices connected by a propagator, which goes like 1/k² squared. So this is indicative of a theory with a kinetic term with four derivatives, I think, which sounds pretty sick and actually is pretty sick. But there is such a theory anyway, and the theory term is conformal supergraphic. And Witten then says that it might be the case that in our string theory we wrote down, we actually, by accident, also includes conformal supergravity in the theory. And that is a problem because if you look at tree level, you can always put your conformal supergravity field to zero and you end up with playing on n equals 4. But at loop level, you always have conformal supergravity modes running around in the loop. So whatever you're calculating at loop level in this theory will contain conformal supergravity modes, so it will not be the thing you're after. Another reason to think that you might end up with conformal supergravity is these things are calculated as some form of chiral determinants. The two-dimensional field theory I just wrote down is actually anomalous. So it's actually not really gauge invariant, which you can find in books like Precht and Schroeder. If you don't have gauge invariants, what is this then? You can definitely cure gauge invariants, but then you would have to do some kind of green Schwarz mechanism where you include basically closed string modes in order to make the anomaly vanish. And that's bad because then you include the closed strings in this open string field theory, and closed strings will also lead you directly again to perform supergraph. So, lucky.
Now you can see so before you say you only consider the open string set of the.
Yes.
Yeah, so how does this perform?
Well, I should mention two things. One of them is that I don't think anybody really understands how you include B1 instantons in string field theory in this particular theory. I mean, on a rigorous level, as far as I know, at least. And B1 instantons are a new invention, and they might. It's conceivable that they might include closed string modes in exactly this way. In writing down these determinants is the most natural guess you can make for what these XOD instantons do. I would like to stress that although this theory seems pretty sick, you can still try to calculate stuff with it. And luckily for us, people did that. So let me mention some related developments after Whitten's article came out. You could try to argue that this conformance with graphy is just due to the formulation of your theory. So you can try to do better than that, and there are several different twisted string formulations on the market at present. It's not even known whether they're all the same, but there are definitely multiple things there. Another thing which came out of all this was different calculational prescriptions of how to calculate tree-level amplitudes in Yang-Mills theory. You might have thought that all tree-level amplitudes by now had been calculated already because they are interesting from a phenomenological perspective. It turns out these are not all calculated, and people have worked hard at getting all the remaining ones soon up. So now, but now you can now you get two different camps. At degree 1, embedding a CP1 in CP3 says 4 is unambiguous. But if I look at degree 2, I could conceivably have two different things. I can embed two lines which are disconnected, or I can embed some curve which is connected and of degree 2. If you look at the disconnect prescription, Freddy, Schwerchick, and Witten showed that you can calculate with these disconnected embedded lines, you can calculate any amplitude at 3W you want. On the connected side, where you embed connected curves in CP3/4, you can show that also there you can calculate basically any amplitude you want. Which is pretty weird because these are completely different prescriptions. There are some arguments relating to those two, but I don't really understand them. I would love to, but I think also that argument is very sketchy at present and more of an idea than an actual proof. Another thing you can do is try to cook up recursion relations where you build up amplitudes out of smaller amplitudes, basically, due to BCF and also includes width. But for our purposes, it's very important that people also try to calculate loop amplitudes with this. If you look at the disconnected prescription, that basically tells you that you have to pick MHV amplitudes and use them as vertices in some effective theory. You guess what the propagator is and sort of derive it from the transcendence kind of perspective, and then you sue those things together, and what you get is basically any tree level known to man. But if you have this prescription of calculating stuff, you can also try to calculate loop level amplitudes. You just take the same prescription where you have these MHV vertices and you connect them by two propagators. Right? What Brunswick, Spence, and Tavernini show is that basically, if you calculate it in this particular way, you get exactly the same structure as people got before in calculating loop amplitudes in N=4. So this prescription seems to work at loop level. But the question begs to be asked now, all of these things are without, especially at loop level, are without some kind of Lagrangian derivation. Any quantum field theory I know because I know it's Lagrangian, right? So, can we cook up some Lagrangian, not the one Whitten used, but one which only contains super Yang-Mills theory or Yang-Mills theory and nothing else? The answer to that is, of course, yes. I should point out that there are two different proposals on the market of how to do that. Both these groups use a version of the following. You take Yang-Mills theory, you gauge fix in some actual Lyapunov light gauge, so you gauge fix most of the symmetry away. Then you cook up some kind of canonical field transformation, which turns the interaction vertices in your theory into the MA3 vertices, which you use in the disconnect description of calculating tree amplitudes. In principle, this is a very clever idea, but I think it hides a lot of what's actually going on here. And also, I'm not completely sure that the Jacobians you use in cooking up such a canonical field transformation are actually completely kosher. Conceivably, it might get contributions at loop level, but it's something you can at least can try.
So it's a claim. It's a claim that in supersymmetric field theories, the Jacobian would be trivial, and then in non-supersymmetric theories, the Jacobian will actually give you the vertices we're missing from the.
Mansfield talks a bit about that. I'm not completely up to speed on what he does exactly, because his article is pretty difficult to read. I think the claim is that the vertices you would have to add to the n equal zero theory are, in some sense, projected out of your theory, or they don't quite know. They don't know where they go.
I think the motivation is that Bardeen at some point proposed all these one-leaf amplitudes with one class or all class of one minus, they are actually coming from an anomaly. So that would have the right flavor to come from this change of variables and picking up an anomaly from the Jacobian.
Yeah.
But I don't think that anybody has succeeded.
No, and I should stress we haven't succeeded either yet, but we at least have a clear idea what's going on. Also, the other thing I should give a bit of an ad for our formalism. In their formalism, we have to work really hard to get any amplitudes out. And in our case, it's completely true. So what's our case, you should ask. So this is I've gone past the introduction. Now we are in the technical interlude. So this is sort of the point to wake up. I'm going to discuss actions written on twisted space. But in twisted space, you always have to pick which reality conditions you use on your space. I'm going to use Euclidean signature twisted correspondence. That is because in Euclidean signature, I know exactly how to rotate to Minkowski signature. And that's a very non-controversial thing to do. But what most people did up to now was use 2.2 signature twisted correspondence, which is technically maybe simpler, but I'm personally not completely sure that Wick rotating is fine in that case, although it probably is, I should concede. Anyway, we're going to study Euclidean signature twisted correspondence. Projective twister space, as I mentioned before, is CP3. What I should also mention is that if you excise from the CP3 a line, and that line basically corresponds to the fact that you need, in spacetime, you need some type of infinity, right? In scattering theory, you need to define your fields at infinity. Infinity in this twisted space corresponds to a line in the CP3, and I get rid of it. In the usual twisted correspondence, you study the space of lines in CP3 itself. If I've got omegas and pi's as denoting, and if I take them together, they've got four components, and those four components are homogeneous coordinates on my C4. If I study the space of lines written in this way, I get something that this XAA prime, which looks remarkably like the XAA prime I showed you right at the beginning of my talk. And what you should ask yourself is, if I give you an omega and a pi, what's the proportionality factor which goes between? Is that something which is completely fixed? And if you want to solve the problem, you find out you need more equations, basically. You don't have enough equations to solve the problem. There's equations you can get by conjugating this equation. And this conjugation will determine the signature of your space and manifold. So if I've got some omega A, which I write as a two-component spinner, I introduce some hat, and this hat gives you minus omega 1, the bar, and the zero we need. And this is exactly the thing you need if you want to study Euclidean signature spinners. I should know that if I take another half of this, I get minus the spin itself. So this reality condition is actually quaternionic. And nothing else. But that won't really matter for us today. So if I have an omega and a phi, I can also write it as this proportionality factor and one of these phis. Actually, you can forget about everything I said. If you just keep in mind that in for twisted space variables, what I need is only some x aa prime, which is now really a coordinate in Euclidean R form. And I need some fiber. And for every coordinate, I have one fiber. So twisted space in Euclidean signature, you just think of as R4 with some non-trivial vibration over it. OK. Now, I was interested in n equals 4 at some point. So I can do the same trick. I take my manifold CP3-4, and I can study the space of lines in CP3-4. So I can bet the CP1-0 inside CP3-4. And what you get, now I guess, is that for the bosonic coordinates, that doesn't really matter. I can still embed some line inside in terms of these omegas and these phis. But the difference is, if I look at the fermionic coordinate, I want to express the fermionic coordinates as a coordinate of the sphere. It's phi a prime. And I have to cook up some proportionality factor. So the easiest thing I can do, and if I just study linear embeddings, is cook up something with two indices. So if I've got four of these, I've got eight of these. And these thetas will pop up some more times in the cell. Now, this is not the only thing I could do. I can also study embedding superlines in terms of inside CP3-4. And it turns out, if you work out the details, that in this case, you get chiral, R4, chiral Euclidean space. In the other case, you get anti-chiral Euclidean space. You could also ask the question, what happens if I embed CP1-2 in this? And you do get something, but we haven't found a use for it. OK, anyway, as I just told you, that you can think of twisted space as just being coordinates and some bundle of some P1 over every point. You can think of CP3-4 as being some anti-chiral coordinates. Just think of it as some form of R4. Basically, the CP1 fiber and theta bars, which where the theta bars are the embedding coordinates here. It should be a theta bar. Okay. Now, after this overview of technical detail, let me remind you that we were interested at some point in this talk in 0.1 forms on CP3-4. In this language, where I split up everything in terms of a space and some bundle over it, forms split up into 0.1 forms split up into something which with two components along the space direction and one component of the fiber. So if I write down E bar A, I mean the two spacetime components, and the E bar 0 is the component of the fiber. I still have my holomorphic flowing form I've got left, and then without further ado, let me present to you how you combine all this into a coherent n equals 4 action. And one way to motivate this action is just to take CSW rules at face value. Write down the thing which gave you the MSV, for instance, in the first place. Write down something which gives you some form of propagator. And combine that. So what do you get? So, natural guess. I'll show that this actually completely correct. You have the holomorphic flowing form. And then you write down holomorphic transcendence theorem, which we knew had to be there in the first place. Then I want to add to that something which will generate for me the MHV vertices. So not the amplitudes, but the vertices. I showed you before that the things you didn't want in this determinate expression were actually the disconnected contractions of that particular you get in that particular determinant. And we already know how to get rid of disconnected pieces in any partition function, right? You take the log of it. So you add a log to that. I'm not claiming this is natural. I'm claiming it works. So what do? You integrate over the space of embeddings of all of CP1s at degree 1 inside CP3/4. And you study this determinant over every CP1 fiber. First thing to note is that this action is a Gaussian variant. And it could have been not a Gaussian variant because I've got this chiral determinant in here. But you can show that adding the log and combining that with the fermionic integration, which is still to follow, would exactly get rid of the anomalous contribution to that determinant. And the Gaussian variance is, of course, just this standard Gaussian variance. But I'd like to point out this is kind of the way, the reason why all this is really neat is that this function chi is just a function on CP3/4. So when you usually have, and usually in your theory, a function on space, which is a four-dimensional thing, here I've got a function on a six-dimensional space as a Gaussian variant. So the Gaussian variant you get in this theory is much larger than you usually have in the Mills theory. Okay, the last thing I need to point out is that the way in which the A form couples in this in these two terms is very peculiar. This term will contain both directions on space-time and direction up the fiber. That term will only contain directions up the fiber. So I've got two different types of vertices a priori in my theory. I've got this one, and I've got everything derived from this. Again, I'm not saying this is obviously Yang-Mills, but let me show you this actually is Yang-Mills. As I'd like to point out again and again and again, I've got more bits in theory than standard Yang-Mills theory. I want to show you that this actually is Yang-Mills theory, so first I have to get rid of the extra Gaussian variance I have. The extra Gaussian variance I have is basically to do with functions pointing up the fibers, right? Because that's the actual bit is. And the natural thing to guess is that on every fiber, so over every point, if you look at every fiber, I demand that my gauge field is actually co-closed. If I demand that something is co-closed on CP1, and the thing itself is a 0,1 form, it's not only co-closed, it's actually harmonic. And in this case, they are harmonic. And every component, since every component has a specific weight, I've got harmonic fields of a specific weight on CP1, and that's sort of a standard calculation in cohomology. For instance, if I look at the weight zero part of my gauge field, gauge multiplet field, my superfield A, then A has a component along spacetime, and it's a component pointing at the fiber. But since it's of weight zero and it's harmonic, that's actually zero. The same way I can treat all the other fields, you'll find that if you look at the -4 component of this, which is called B, you get that up the fibers of the E0 direction, you get something which has two free spinner indices left. But this itself is not a function on fiber anymore, it's just a function of the space-time point. So all the fiber dependence is in these pi hats, pi hat A prime and pi hat B prime, and I also have space direction left. Okay, as I tried to emphasize before, I have not fixed the complete gauge symmetry yet. I've got some things left. So if I look at the residual gauge field in my field A, I have to know which fields are actually obey this particular equation, where L means restricted to the fiber. And it turns out that this can only be satisfied if H is actually a function of spacetime itself, and not of any fiber component. Well, that's something we know and love, hopefully. That's just gauge symmetry on R4. So in everything I do after this, I still have residual gauge field, which I'm not going to fix because I'm actually aiming for to get to the Jengel's action directly. But I've gauge fixed, and if I do gauge fixing, I always have to worry about ghosts. Now the nice thing is that the ghosts, in this case, actually decouple. That is cool. The reason they decouple is that by putting this gauge condition on the CP1, some components of my gauge field actually vanish. Some components of your gauge field actually vanish, remind you of an actual type gauge, and in actual gauges, the ghosts always decouple. Technically, the reason it happens here is that if I write down my gauge fixing term by just writing down some BRC variation of some other field, I get some gauge fixing term, exactly the type of one, and I get my ghost terms in my action. I can classify that these fields C are, of course, again, superfields. So I can expand them out and look at how the components couple. It turns out that the non-component of C bar couples to minus 4 component of C, and so I get some diagonal like this. And if I look at what this field couples to, since a lot of components in this field vanish, you'll find that only this upper corner is actually non-zero. If I calculate the determinants of this particular type of matrix, I already know that these vertices will never contribute to anything in here, and this particular bit of your action decouples. And you might not believe me, because this seems like a little esoteric argument, so I invite you all to write down the diagrams, and then you also see that you can never get any contribution to your theory whatsoever. Okay, and from now on, it's actually plain sailing. This is actually the technical bit of our paper. So what you have to do is to insert back into the action the gauge fixed field. So I have some components vanish, some other components trivialize, sort of. First of all, I need to expand out all my superfields, so I do the integration of my Fermionic coordinates. And what you'll find for the term sinus part of the action is that you get some field B, remember that's the field you get, which is left, which only depends on space time, times something which starts to look remarkably like the field strength tensor of Jengel's theory. However, there's a lot more junk here, and it contains some auxiliary fields. So there's some things which only appear in the action quadratically or linearly. So you can integrate those out and can substitute back into the action the resulting equations you get. Then, I still, in this Onca bar key, I still have the integration of the fiber left. But since all my fields are actually trivial of the fiber, for instance, this B field only depends on X, not of course in the fiber, I can do that integration. What you're left with is actually something which is B times F, field B times the field strength tensor of the field A. And this is the part where I can suddenly get down to BF theory. Actually, you could have started at the point where Witten started to discuss holomorphic to sinus theory, you could just as well have tried to cook up some BF theory, and that would actually lead you directly to n equals zero in Jengel theory. An action like this has been studied before by Chalmers and Siegel. This part of it is, since this has spinner indices, it's actually the self-dual part of the field strength, the full Jengel's field strength. And this particular theory describes a chiral half of the theory. This is not Jengel's theory yet. I need something more. Something more is in the second term.
I have a question about gauge invariants. In your initial action, it was a commutative gauge invariant. So non-commutative comes from where?
Sorry, the gauge invariants had a Morosian axis.
Well, it's just like, you know, it's an abelian gauge invariant.
No, it's not abelian.
So, at the end of the day, it's not abelian, but where? The initial theory is an abelian one.
The initial theory is also the non-abelian one. At some point I wrote down the linear field equations, but that was when I discussed string theory. It's really non-abelian. Okay. you can also guess that because if I say German science theory, I wrote down these three, four, the three variables, which are the definition.
So how you get
them
to action?
Huh?
How you get them the action start from P times term plus this instant correction. So that term you guess. You said you guessed.
I said guess because at that point I thought I'd sort of half motivated it's a natural guess. But the only reason I really wrote it down because I know it will work. Another way you could derive it actually is start off with the BF theory. If I write down actually, this is the way Lionel found it. If I write up something like this, where this is the self-dual part of basically the full field A, then this action basically as a field equation just as the self-dual part of F zero, right? So this is not Fourier-Mill theory. But how you can, if you add terms like this to it, then if you draw a field equation, this turns out to be F plus squared, which is
self-dual.
Yeah, well, it's the self-dual part of your mills, but you can always add the topological term to this, and that will give you Fourier mills. So I could have motivated the same action by starting off in mill theory, picking out this field, knowing that in the end I'm going to put some gauge condition on the field of twister space, and then just guess what the twister space formulation is. That will exactly give you, in any zero case, it will exactly give you the right term to add to the action. But in n equals 0, it's ambiguous whether or not you have a log or not. But if you look at the n equals 1, 2, and 3 case, and 4 case, you find out that you have to put the log. So that's not the way you could have done it, and that's also the way Lionel did it.
Where did this B field make up in terms of the original
field? The B field, that's actually a very good question, because as I really want to stress time and time again, these fields don't really have physical interpretation until on twister space until after you put the field equations. And the B field is like, but not completely, it's not completely the minus part of the gluon field. I can tell you afterwards what it really is, but it's the physical interpretation of these fields on twister space until you've gauge fixed is a bit weird. In this gauge, it's completely obvious, because B here is just some auxiliary field, and you can integrate it out, and will give you Yang-Mills action right in the middle. In this case, if you look at the second term, the superfield, since some of my components are zero, the superfield expansion actually starts at theta squared. That's order theta squared. So the expansion of this logarithm is actually finite. I can do the same trick. I can integrate over all the fiber integrals I get from this. And what you'll find is that you get exactly the dB term plus fermion completion to n equals 4 by the node. If you then add them, you can see, just by studying the terms, that this thing is actually equivalent to n equals 4 super and mill theory. And I'd like to stress that in this being able to do integrals like this is special to this gauge. If you pick any other gauge, you'll be left with, in your formulation will contain a lot of integrals over fibers. And usually you can do these, and if you want to study, if you want to calculate anything physical, actually you know you should be able to do them, because otherwise you'll never be left with something on space-time. You don't have any quantum corrections because the quantum corrections, and the only place where you could have gotten more quantum corrections was in the ghost bar reaction. Perturbatively, this is superior mill theory. However, a very next question that should be, at least, can I put any other gauges? And my apologies if I'm a bit sketchy at this point, but there are some things slightly left unfixed. The idea is, if you want to get the CSW rules, as Freddy and others derived, you have to pick an unformulated form. So we back up a bit, and we start off with the action again, and now we pick an extra type gauge, where we actually have to do some spinner, eta a, which is exactly the spinner they have in their formulation. And I put this component of a to be zero. This is actual, of course, and if you look at it, what it means in space-time, it looks like, but it's not quite the same as putting a light cone or a space cone gauge. It actually would be the space cone or the light cone gauge if I didn't put A here, but if I put A here up to components of the fiber. Because if I first put the harmonic gauge, or the gauge I showed before, I can then put this gauge, and then I get light cone space cone gauge. In this case, I get something more. So this is actually something only written on twister space. In an actual gauge, the transimus vertex in these theories vanishes, as it usually does, and I can calculate from this action, can calculate its propagators and its on-shell fields. It turns out that in the supersymmetric case, all the neat things happen up the fiber. Only the components of the fiber matter. And I only get propagators, non-trivial propagators, four components of the fiber, and I only have to take into account all the MHV vertices which came from the second part of the action. This is all fine and dandy, and we already know from the literature that the CSW rules, at least in one loop, seem to work. We also know that n equals zero in n equals zero is not completely true. And it turns out that exactly in n equals zero we've got some problems in really deriving the CSW rules. The basic problem is that we have got some problems with the transimus vertex, and it might not completely vanish, and that's actually what we're calculating right.
So about n equal to zero, you were mentioning in the beginning that the transimus theory is anomalous there, so you have to go to n equal to 4.
No. The anomaly in MS for transimus theory is when you want to consider string theory with CP3 target space.
Yes.
So if I study B-metal with the CP3 target space, there's an anomaly in symmetries I need in order to twist the theory. So there it doesn't work. But that kind of argument is only really holds true when I want to study string theory with such a target space. I can't just write down this action in n equals zero.
You mean Jan Simons on CP3?
Yes.
And there's no problem.
If I were to consider that as some string theory, there would be a problem. But here, I'm just interested in writing down anything which gives me just the Mills theory. And then I don't have to worry about stuff like that. I should point out that these problems are actually good, because it's known that the CSW formalism is not completely closed in the n equals zero case. So we hope. Well, I hope at least that this week there will be some more light in this problem.
Sorry, can we go back to the previous?
Yes.
So what's the gauge symmetry that is left after?
Basically, anything which is usually vary in this gauge condition. So that basically means anything which is, if you look at what it means in terms of the gauge symmetry itself, it means that you get functions which don't depend on that particular direction on twister space.
Okay.
So that's, in some sense, a pretty large gauge symmetry. Actually, you have the same problem if you do actual type gauge fixing in regular Yang-Mills theory. And that's actually a problem which has not really been studied. I only know one paper which really fixes the residual gauge symmetry and then tries to derive propagates and stuff.
So in particular, does it still contain gauge symmetry in space time?
In this case, it's a bit hard to tell. It does contain some symmetry in space-time, but if I have four directions in space, then I use two of them to make a complex direction. And then with that kind of gauge-fixing condition, I basically gauge-fix one of those away. It turns out nothing depends on the other one. But then I've got two directions on space-time left, and I've got the components of the fiber. But it seems really weird to write down gauge fixing conditions for something which only depends on two space-time directions, right? Mm-hmm. We tried to do that, actually, and that doesn't really work. But there's more ways of seeing the problem.
So, yeah, I'm not sure of the result. So if you do that, you still get this BF plus S2 terms.
If you do that,
you wrote on S2, but it's not
Yeah, you still, yeah. And, you still get the same, yeah, you still get the same structure. Only then you don't really get the F theory because in the F in the curvature part there is also the transimous vertex. What you're left with in this case is let's see. It looks like this. So you get this A wedge B bar of B part of your multiply. Mm-hmm. And then in the other part, you get basically something which looks like this. Something which depends on two fiber components and then contains some holomorphic frames. It looks something like this. In these homework frames, there is actually the gauge field A and Z. So H is a function of field A. I can write that for you at some point. It's actually just the average V vertices right on the node. So that's another way of doing it. Okay, we're almost there. In our paper, we do something more actually than just H4. We show explicitly how to reduce to 1 and 2, n equals 1 and n equals 2. We don't show how to reduce to n equals 0, but that's actually completely obvious from the paper itself. Basically, the idea is to reduce the R symmetry of your theory. Or another way you could put it is if I give you an n equals 4 multiply, you're clever enough to get out of that the multiples you need in order to write n equals 2, then you set the other ones to 0. We can also write down matter in all representations known to man. The way you do that is, if I give you an n equals 4 multiple, I can decompose that into an n equals 2 multiple coupled to matter in the adjoint, right? So if I've got matter in the adjoint, I can just by hand change the representation of that matter. But then I have to worry about whether or not this actually is something which gives you something on space-time. So you need to find some extra symmetry in order to be able to put the same kind of gauge conditions I put before. And it turns out that you can. We show explicitly for fundamental matter how to do that. Let me stress again. This class of theories contains actually three unit matter in fundamental, Maslow's matter in this case. And no supersymmetry, which is kind of cool. Okay, let me come to some conclusions. My conclusions, as I started off this talk with, my conclusions are actually pretty simple. We can formulate standard gauge theory as a gauge theory on transistor states. Its quantization, at least in one particular gauge, is perfectly fine and doesn't involve anything which looks like or smells like conformal supergravity. I should stress that some field theory people sometimes claim that there's no off-shell superfield formulation of n equals 4. I've just written down one. The only problem with this formulation is that it doesn't live in 4 dimensions, but in 6. But there's a but.
So can you now prove all the statements like there are no UV divergences,
probably.
The beta function is 0 to 1.
But actually, I'm coming to the part where I list open questions, and one of the questions you might have is you can prove statements like that usually quite easily through holomorphism. Right? Just look up the appropriate article on Cyberg and you see that it actually works. We don't quite know how holomorphy works in this case because our action is not. Does not contain, for instance, the topological term, so we cannot write down chiral couplings to the we cannot write down a chiral gauge coupling. But we know from basically N equals 2 arguments that holomorphy should work, so can we see it in some way in this theory? I don't know. But in some sense, we should be able to do stuff like that. Yeah. Okay. As I said before, I have loads of open questions. apart from the n equals zero question I mentioned before, one very obvious question is, are these theories unitary at all? Gauge shadow directed. We know one gauge in which a theory is equivalent to a unitary gauge theory, so that's probably okay, but you could worry about that in all other gauges. People in real theory at least have worried about it in all other gauges. Another really important point is that the renormalization of these theories in any other gauge than standard Lorentz type gauge on spacetime is going to be weird. And that's something to work out. But that's the same question really as the question of how do you do loop calculations neatly or maybe more efficiently in these types of theories. We know of several examples in the literature where you can study loop type calculations, but there are more loops to calculate. As a more general thing, you could ask a question, does this give you any new insight into your favorite gauge theory question, like beta functions in n equals 4, anything? You can split this up into several things, and the perturbation theories of this is of course interesting, and you'd like to see more stuff than just what I've shown you before. The recursion relations are, you might obtain from this, okay, let me back up a bit. You might obtain the recursion relations from this. There's actually an MB-twister formulation which is pretty close to deriving the recursion relation. But showing that would be very nice. I'd like to stress that if twisters have been good for anything up to now, it was for finding solutions to the self-dual William-Mills equations, so instant odds. There's probably all kinds of nice instanton calculations you might be able to do here. Actually, there's a student in Oxford now working on perturbation theory in a series in the background of one instanton, or MHV-like things in the background of one instanton. I'd also like to mention here, of course, well, anything which has to do with n equals 4 has to do with AESCT. Our action has bits in it, which are actually tau functions of integrable hierarchies. Does that mean anything? Regarding questions of integrability or transcendentality in the new bus pockets? I don't know. Yeah. Last gauge theory question I'd like to highlight is twisting gauge theory, and that actually has something to do with the instant calculations I mentioned before. There is a slight hope you might be able to do Nekrasov's calculations in n equals 2 directly in this theory. But that uses some form of twisted topological field theory. And I'm not really quite sure yet whether it's going to work. Okay, there's two twisted things to mention. This is twisted theory. So twisted theory usually is formulated in terms of Czech cosmology instead of Dolbo cosmology, as I've been using up to now. And at least Penrose is always going on about that you should really use Czech cosmology. So maybe there's a Czech cosmology version of this theory. We don't know. Another thing to note is that there are something called twister diagrams. Nobody knows what those are, I should say. But Andrew Hodges in Oxford is pushing that idea. He seems to be able to calculate anything, any amplitude in n equals 4 and in n equals 0 tree level, or in n equals 4 also tree level, by using some really simple algebra. And everybody who knows of it agrees that it's something really deep. But nobody knows where it comes from. That's really something to say. Last but not least, when asked a question, is this a string theory? Our theory is pretty close, I would say. At least homomorphic to sound a bit, it's completely obvious that that is part of a topological string theory. What's the other term then? And I'd like to leave you with two suggestions. One of them is that the term you can massage a bit, as we did in our paper. What you get looks like the generating functional for all invariants associated to a holomorphic link. It's holomorphic to Sam's theory. In Sam's theory, I can study linking of curves. Maybe here you can study linking of holomorphic curves. We don't know, but it looks a bit like it. Another suggestion you could wonder about is there is some way of trying to rewrite this extra term as a determinant not on the CP1, but as a determinant on full chiral or anti-chiral superspace. If you do that, you get something which looks bloody close to B plus B bar model. So instead of just looking at chiral things or looking at the B twist, I also say the B bar twist, and if I add those two together and cook up some conditions on the fields, you get something which looks almost like the thing we get, but not quite. And it's completely likely there's actually explanation C, which I haven't written down here, but that's for you to discover. Thanks. Questions?
Yeah, one question. When you have a transcendental theory here in CP3, it's natural to cover it to a boundary with a minimum written term. So what would be the interpretation of this with a minimum written term from the gauge theory boundary?
It's a good question, but I don't know. It's exactly, I mean, it's things like this.
It reminds me of this, yeah, I think you're right, because it reminds me, you were trying to write down Kobayashi Maas term in 4 years, and that looks like the most natural thing to try. Because the structure of this Kobayashi Maas term has a structure of a resume term, so.
As far as I know, don't really try to do the type of canonical quantization you would need to do in order to get the resume written. I mean, as you usually get the Western mean written in the transcendent theory. That's I looked at that Carabali and Nair article, and it looked close, but I never managed to make it work. It would be very interesting to make it work.